Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And today, it's an interview I did before coronavirus. And I feel that's very important to say because why is Matt not talking about it with this winemaker? The winemaker is J.P. Collat, an award-winning winemaker, won a bunch of awards back in the day making wine in Chablis, and has now been working at the 13th Street Winery here in Niagara for decades. And I have to say first, I have been trying to get this interview for about a year. Really, since I started doing this podcast, he was on the list. And the reason is I've drank their wines for close to a decade. They used to be represented by Barrel Select, the one that the winery, the wine agency that you guys now know, because talked about them a bunch, done a bunch of their winemakers. There'll be more in the future. And recently, though, they've moved over. I'm talking about 13th Street. They're now represented by Noble Estate Winery. And Noble Estate Winery, another good place to go for wine, for your consignment wine. If you want to look them up, really easy. They are just at nobleestates.com. Mid-size wine agency here in the province of Ontario. Again, I like to give love to a lot of different wine consignment companies that do good work. And if you're looking for a great portfolio of Ontario wine, 13th Street, they're sparkling, their single vineyard Rieslings and Chardonnays are really good. But the one wine, or the one grape, excuse me, that they're really sort of hung their hat on is Gamay. And J.P. Collat is, he is certainly focused on it. It is a passion for him. And it was a passion for the winery even before J.P. Collat took over. I don't know why I keep saying J.P. He's also Jean-Pierre Collat. So this interview, the interesting thing, when I went to meet him, the first time I saw him, he was driving the forklift. And I wasn't sure it was him. I'm like, is that him? Because I knew what he looks like. But why is the winemaker driving the forklift? And it was another reminder of, hey, if you're a winemaker, you're more than just the guy or the girl in the field checking the grapes or deciding, you know, fermentation technique and stuff like that. So definitely an important lesson. Now, this interview is a two-parter. We went well over an hour, so I've split it up into two parts. And so the first part, we talk a lot about his journey, the difference between making wine in Chablis versus Ontario, his issues with Cabernet Sauvignon in Ontario. In fact, he also has issues with Pinot Noir. He was actually pretty controversial. It's a fun little story about how he finally got into Pinot Noir and how a lot of his colleagues who didn't like the fact that one of their own was kind of ripping on Pinot Noir finally decided to make it. So he was under a lot of pressure, his viticulture philosophy, all that sort of stuff. So that is the first part of the interview. It ends with his wine philosophy. I'm going to give a shout out to a wine I am drinking right now, the 2017 Gamay from Sandstone Vineyard. And this wine on the nose, fresh red fruit, almost like red fruit pie and roses and a little bit of pepper. And on the nose, or excuse me, on the palate, this is vibrant cherry. This is just a very pretty floral red fruit driven wine, medium bodied throughout, slightly smoky spice finish, and the acidity. Like, this is just a really fresh, bright wine. And I'm going to call this happy acidity because it's not the kind that makes you pucker, you know, if you're having a really intense German Riesling. This is just this beautiful, happy, vibrant acid. This is a really good Gamay. And this is the kind of bottle where you're going to want to have more than one glass. It isn't heavy. It's just a really beautiful Gamay from a winery that makes really good Gamay. So without, and I always say without further ado, because I can't think of a cleverer way to start the interview, because, you know, at this point, I'm just yammering. Hope everyone is safe. Hope everyone is good. Thank you very much for listening to the pod, for subscribe. You know, remember, subscribe, rate, review, tell your friends, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, part one, it took a little over a year. I badgered him a ton. I basically just cornered him one day in a winery and at his winery and forced him to say yes. It was actually a really awkward conversation. I don't bring it up in this interview because, again, awkward. So here it is, Jean-Pierre Collat.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I'm very excited for this one. I've chased this man down for ages. I've drank his wine for over a decade. Hell, for a brief period, I used to work for this winery. I'm at 13th Street Winery, and the winemaker, JP, or Jean-Pierre Collat, thank you so much for joining the pod.
Okay, but no problem. Yeah. My pleasure.
So, by the way, for this interview, do you prefer Jean-Pierre, JP? What is the most comfortable way? I just thought about this when I got started. How do you want me to address?
Well, you know, Jean-Pierre is the original, but JP is the beautiful shortcut that you have here in North America. And just basically, I think it just doesn't matter really to me.
Okay.
I was a bit more picky about that at the beginning. Now, I don't care. I'm following the flow.
I'll try Jean-Pierre, but who knows? I might go down the other way.
No big deal.
So I had all these questions. And I wanted to go back to your backstory and, you know, making brilliant wines in Chablis and Grand Cru, and then you've done so much great work here. You're a famous winemaker, and at 9:35 this morning, you were driving the forklift, loading and unloading pallets of wine. Once again, when people think about being a winemaker as this romantic, carefree world, it is the exact opposite.
Well, you know, the romantic work in the wine business, it's probably more for the sommelier, but everybody forget that. The winemaker is just the day-to-day life, is just all the nice, exciting job and all the bad, dirty job that nobody is seeing. But in fact, you know, we are a small facility, just all the production is made pretty much on the two guys, and my cellar guy is off this week, so basically I have to do everything, but it's what I'm doing on a regular basis. You have to do the logistics, you have to do the maintenance, you have to do the cleaning, you have to do the winemaking, but I would like to say it's not what's taking the most of the time, you know, between the office work, the lab work, the day to day, you know, just tasting and deciding what we're going to do on the blend. I don't know how many percent, but it's not the major part, even if it's the most exciting, of course. But
when I studied, when I got my diploma in the WSET years ago, and there's all the stuff you got to study about what it means to be a winemaker and, you know, choosing when to pick and blending and acid. No point in any of my textbook did it say how to learn how to drive a forklift. How long have you been driving a forklift? Would you consider yourself a very... Because when I saw you on it, I just assumed it was one of the workers. That was their job. I didn't realize that was you on it.
Well, you know, just... I'm a very long-time trained forklift driver, even before coming here in Canada. But it's part of the routine, you know, just... If you don't have a big crew, if you're not in a big winery with lots of staff, you have to be efficient. You have to do a little bit of everything. When I talk about the logistic, managing the warehouse, having everything available, ready for the staff, for the retail, working with the, you know, we have new building, but we are already too small. So just we have an outside storage. So it's in and out all the time. We are sending wine, we are bringing wine, we are just moving, and it's much easier and faster to do yourself.
Yeah.
You know, just you have to organize your time. Time is precious, of course, so it's a very important exercise. We're going to do that, after, in a way to be able to achieve something else. And, you know, you don't have time to go and just to wait for an extra staff and just to... some guys in the big places perhaps are doing that, but it's not the way I'm working. It's not the way I want to work, because I'm a production guy. You know, I'm not an office winemaker. I'm not a lab winemaker. I need to be involved. I need to have my hands on the product in the process, and. It's part of the philosophy of the winemaking, because it's not a big revolution that you're going to that's going to help you to make the difference. Winemaking, it's part of everything, every day, all year long. It's just the details. It's just what you're going to do. It's just the conditions of what you're going to do. It's just the caution that you're going to put on every single step. But it's also passing through the organization. You know, just if you have a clean, organized, pristine production place, and just you think the work is going to be done easier. Mm-hmm. The result is supposed to be better when you are not struggling with anything. You have better results, and you're going further on much easier paths. So,
a clean and organized workspace makes for easier work.
Oh, it's very obvious.
Yeah.
It's very obvious in the regular time during the year, but it's even more obvious during harvest. During harvest, you have to keep the same organization, just to have everything clean all the time, and just you can't push to do just to keep that for later and thing. You should be surprised. During harvest, it's a little bit more messy, of course.
But
it's still the same importance on the details and how to be organized and clean and rinse and everything at its own place and. You're going to save time and you're going to work in better conditions. So
I want to bounce around a lot. And the crazy thing is how big you guys have expanded. And I want to get there in a little bit from where you were back in the early 2010s. But I want to go back a little bit of your journey. I was doing some reading, and you know, before you became the winemaker at the Domaine Loche in Chablis, you were an apprentice for, I believe, about 15 years. I was wondering if you could tell me just what those years were like. What was that like growing up in that area and just working your way up to winemaker?
We have to be clear, because just basically before going to my life in the wine and in the winemaking.
Yeah, what got you into wine to begin with?
At the beginning, it was not the first decision, because when I was at school, just after the baccalaureate in France, just basically after high school in Canada here, local, my only reason just to continue was just to do phys ed university. I was a big sport guy. I was playing lots of different things in national level. And
what was your favorite sport?
European handball, volleyball, track and field.
Yep.
I was doing 400 meters hurdlers. I was doing long jump. I was doing and basically I was always coaching kids and just in that when I was young, and I wanted to continue like that. But unfortunately, you know, with the high competition level, you pass through injuries and multiple injuries, and at some point after, you have to ask you the question: just okay, am I going to be able to continue like that? What's going to be the future? And just after this, just, you know, one time the ankle, after the knee, and just it's a little bit kind of complicated to stay on the top level. And I went to the phys ed university. I experimented some of just kind of frustration and disagreement, because just the intensity and the level of the kids' connection and the psychology and the coaching on the floor, on the field, on the track and field, it just was just a little bit just too slow and a little bit boring and frustrating for me.
Right.
So after I went, I turned back to my natural original passion. I grew up in a vineyard in Chablis. I grew up in a family of grower family. My grandparents were growers in Chablis. And I always made harvest. I was always skipping school just to go for harvest during the weekdays. I always smelled the fermentation in the barrel cellar underground at my grandparents' place. I always been part of all the works and the details. And even going further than that, just basically I think because my parents were working, I learned to walk in the vineyard, just grabbing and catching the wires, following my grandmother during the vineyard work. I learned to prune the vineyard at 5 years old, and basically I've been immersed in that pretty much all my young life. So it's a little bit of the very, very
long and basic background, but I'm somewhere. I'm a grower. I'm a peasant. I'm not, as I said before, I'm not a lab guy, an office. I think lots of the things are made in the vineyard and in the cellar, and it's the most exciting. It's the most true exercise for me.
So I also read you did brief stints in South America and New Zealand. Did you work at Oyster Bay, at Oyster Bay Winery in New Zealand?
Yeah, I've done part of the harvest in 2002 at Oyster Bay. Mm-hmm. At this time, it was based in Auckland, but it was a very, very nice experience for me, yeah.
Because what I'm curious about is, what was it like, because Oyster Bay is a much more large-scale wine operation versus something like here at 13th Street. I'm just... What for you were some of the biggest differences in terms of working for one of such large scale and one that's so much smaller?
Well, you know, in fact, I've been trained in a large scale because when I was at Domaine La Roche in Chablis, basically in the 90s, it was a big, large production facility. I moved from that because I wanted to be more involved in a bit of everything on a day-to-day life. You know, in Chablis, I was just 100% production in the cellar. Mm-hmm. It was just the detail of every single thing just prepare the wine for the bottling. But I was not close enough to the vineyard. It was a full-time colleague vineyard manager, and it's a different scale.
Right.
So it was not very different from my past. But of course, here in this kind of size, at 13th Street, you need to be present on every single point, and you need to be efficient on every single point. But I think you have a better vision of what you can achieve, and you have a better control. You are playing with the nature, you are playing with the climate, you are doing what you can do, function of what you receive from Mother Nature. And you are not deciding everything on the lab or at the press when you receive the grapes. It's a bit more integrated, exciting aspect of the job.
I want to talk about control, but before that, we're going to try two of the wines of your 13th Street wines. I was wondering if you could tell the listeners, these are two of your classic lines. One of your sparkling rosés and your gamay. So why don't you talk a little bit about these two wines we're going to try?
Well, sparkling rosé, it's the most ancient and...
And I'll open it as you're talking.
Yep, the oldest big volume of wine from 13th Street. It's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay at the beginning in the traditional method, just following the pure champagne process. The only little change I've made in the years since I arrived here in 2009 is just I integrate a bit of Gamay in the blend for the color, for the... for the color, for the fruit flavors, and for the freshness. Big production for us, from 20 to 25,000 bottles. It's vintages essentials now. It's still the brut, from 8 to 10 grams of sugar. Méthode traditionnelle, I mentioned, 12 to 24 months on lease. On aging, faster and faster rotation, because I'm just moving a little bit from my process on this rosé, and being the first on the list and the largest, we are moving from this blend to different other varietals. Now we have five different labels of sparkling, but the rosé is always the common denominator, the most popular, just the biggest volume. Everybody knows the rosé from 13th Street. It's just a very friendly, easy to go cocktail reception, food, just a nice color, easy going sparkling, yeah, from every day and from everybody.
Yeah, no, whenever we come by, and we've been here a bunch, my girlfriend or a twin sister, they always grab at least one bottle on the way out. I think for listeners who don't know, obviously it's not made in Champagne, but your methods are the same? And I was wondering if you could just explain to some of the listeners how you, this wine that we're going to try and like the aging, you go through most of the same standards of wine production as what happened in Champagne.
Well, it's exactly the same process. If we have been in Champagne, it would have been called Champagne. We are not in Champagne, so we can't use the name. But it's exactly the same process. You prepare the base wine from the different varietals, and basically, when we say base wine, the still wine, very high acidity, low alcohol, just to be able to go for the second fermentation in bottle. You re-ferment, you reintroduce active yeast. Just to ferment and to go to the next step, you integrate a little bit of sugar just to be able to re-ferment and to create the effervescence and to create the pressure in the bottles. And after you put a crown cap like a beer cap on top of the bottles and you put in aging. You're going to lay down for a few months, a few years, function of the taste, function of what you want to achieve. And after you reopen, we are going to the phase of basically riddling. We are getting rid of the little sediments from the tanks, from the bottles. We put the bottle upside down. We are rotating the bottles. You have seen that in some films and movies and things like that. Just rotating the bottles to have the sediments going down to the neck. We freeze the neck. We get rid of the sediments with the little ice cube, and we refill. Sometimes we refill with a little bit of dosage, with a little bit of sugar syrup concentration, just for what we call liqueur d'expédition, just the last little touch. So it's why on this dry wine and the beginning in the bottle, we have a little bit of sweetness because we adjust for the palate of the general customer. And this is 100% the process of the Champagne.
And well, first off, cheers. Thank you so much. On the nose on this fella, just like the fresh red fruit is coming out. The effervescence is there. You do get some of, that little bit of that toasty champagne thing going on. But yeah, like just you said very just fun, friendly, welcoming. But there's just a lot of depth going on. It's a lovely sparkling rosé.
Yeah, so in average, it's about 2 years on lees, and the nose is a combination of the strawberry, raspberry, a little bit of red currant with a little bit of kind of a tart rhubarb and a little bit of kind of a sweetness just to be able to enhance and to push and to show up a little bit more of the fruit flavors. Just keeping the freshness, keeping the acidity, nice little fruit flavors, 2 years on lees, just to have a little bit of the autolysis, to have a little bit of the lees aging your bottle.
That comes out on both the nose and the palate.
Yeah, it's a nice combination, but at the same time, I don't want to push too far on that because I want to stay on the freshness. I want to stay on the fresh fruit. I want just to have that easy sipping. It's not going to be a big, heavy toasty and old sparkling when you have lots of autolysis and lots of creaminess and lots of toasted bread and everything. On the rosé, it's a little bit different. On the rosé, you want to stay on the fresh red berry fruit and just to have that a bit more exciting and just basically just for, you know, just for any kind of, you don't need to wait for a big occasion.
This is a great Tuesday night. This would be fantastic on a Tuesday night. I liked a rhubarb, absolutely. Like I didn't catch that on the nose, but on the after. And you're right; just all the red fruits are coming out. Yep. It's a wonderful, fresh, sparkling. So, getting back to it, the idea of control, and this is something I like to ask a lot of the winemakers: how tough is it? Because you're in every part of making of the wine. You're driving the forklift, so you get to exert a good amount of control. But then out there, when nature kind of takes over, you sort of have to put your hands up and go, I'm no longer in control. How difficult is that, just having to deal when there's tough moments in a vintage?
We would love to be on total control, yes. Of course, but yes. We are working with Mother Nature, we are working with the climate, and we know that, and I know for being from outside, working in different countries and things like that, that the weather, the climate in Ontario can be very, very unstable and inconsistent. We are passing from warm, hot, dry Californian vintage to some very cold, rainy, very bad winters with winter damage and some rainy, cold summers and things like that. And we have to adjust ourselves. So at this point, we don't have the control, but we have to be as reactive as possible. Basically, trying to anticipate, it's a little bit difficult, but basically trying to understand what this fluctuation of weather are going to bring us in the vineyard, what we have to do to adjust ourselves, our growing skills to the vineyards, to the vines, how we're going to interfere with the canopy management, how we're going to interfere with the water management, how we're going to avoid some of the basic crazy hot summers, how we're going to avoid the sunburn on the grapes because of the leaf removal and things like that. So we have to adjust, we have to relearn all the time, we have to stay very humble because, again, we are not driving the business.
Yeah.
We are just doing our best to take benefit of what we have. Some years it's easy, some years it's not easy at all, and some years it's just a pain, and everything, and we know, and we have to admit that everything we are going to do is going to influence the end of the product. The end of the product, basically, it's not the grapes. The grapes is important, but the end of the product for the winemaker is the wine. So how your decision are going to influence the grapes, and how the result on the grapes are going to influence your wine at the end. Because basically, we are not growing grapes. We are not selling grapes. We are making wine.
Yeah.
We need the best grapes as possible, of course, but we need the best grapes as possible, suitable for the best wine as possible.
Not just the best looking grapes.
No,
it's not. You don't want the big plump ones. You want ones that probably look horrible but make the best wine. All your years in Chablis, I mean, that's a more of a cool climate winemaking area. How much of your learning and your experience there, how much translates to what you do here in Niagara? Or is it completely different?
Well, you know, of course, when you start to work with vineyard, when you start to work with climate, you have lots of just a very normal common sense rules that basically you have to do these things, you have to do this thing, you don't have to do that because it's not going to, you know, you are playing with the ground, you are playing with your underground, you are playing with the richness of the soil, the mineral concentration, you are working with the amount of rain in the year. And what kind and the amount of rain per month you are working with you still are working with the frost. You know, in Chablis it was more the spring frost because it was not the same winters. Here in Ontario it's more the absolute cold in the winter, so it's more the winter damage. We almost avoid the spring frost because the vegetation is starting much later. And you know, we used to say that we have almost no spring. We are passing from the winter to the summer,
right?
In a matter of 1 week, you know, basically just you forget the cold, the snow, and the frozen ground, and you have this big heat, and the vegetation is growing much faster than in a temperate climate normal that I'm used to. But you have learned your base at the beginning, and basically after you have to adjust yourself at the specifics of the region. Of course, here much colder temperature in the winter, much longer winter, amount of snow. In fact, we would prefer to have more snow in a regular base just to be able to protect the vines and the grafts and the vegetal itself. But we have to play with that. We have to play with the underground drainage just to be able to evacuate the melting water from the snow. We have to integrate that the growing season is going much faster than in Europe, basically, because just we don't have the, when the vegetation is starting, it's going very, very fast. You have to double the staff in the vineyard just to be able to cover all the work, not to be cut by the time, and just it's just to learn again how to adjust yourself, just the basic simple human people and human work in front of the power of the nature and the climate.
I want to go with two quotes, and these are a decade ago, so things could have changed. One I agree with, one I'm skeptical. And I hate being skeptical for someone in front of you because, you know just a wee bit more than I do. And that is sarcasm. 2010, you talked about Cabernet Sauvignon. It's heresy, a crazy, stupid idea. I love that quote. When I started getting into Canadian wine and they had all these Cabernet Sauvignons, which I guess they made for profit because everyone recognizes that grape. And those wines were green and stocky and underripe and unpleasant. Where do you stand now on Cabernet Sauvignon in Ontario or specifically here in Niagara?
Okay, so yeah, I have said that, and I probably
and that was a decade ago, yeah, so things can change.
And I can still probably say that because it's not the most friendly varietal in Ontario. In fact, before coming here in Ontario, I was just passing through South America, Chile and Argentina, and my biggest experience of Cab Sauv is more coming from South America. So of course, you don't have the same conditions, you don't have the same wines at the end, and guess what, some are just drinking easier than others, it's very difficult because just Cabernet Sauvignon needs some climate that we are not always able to supply, and because of the long winter, because of the very short period of growing, some years we can do the Cabernet Sauvignon, but we need to have those big hot vintage 2002, 2007, 2012. When you have the heat coming from the south, when the kind of vintage that I call Californian vintage, yeah, it starts in the spring, it continues through the summer, and on top we are lucky enough to have this Indian summer, very specific to Canada, to Ontario, and when we have all the magic conditions, we have Cabernet Sauvignon ripe. We can have the ripeness in sugar, but the ripeness in sugar is not making everything. You have the alcohol content, but after you want to have the ripeness on the tannins, on the polyphenols, and the ripeness on the polyphenols and the tannins, it's a different story. It's a different ripeness. And after, we need all those conditions, and we can make great, and we have made great. But how can you build a business in a region if you have only 1 or 2 years in a decade? Okay, everybody's going to remember it.
Yeah.
But the year after, they want the same.
Yeah.
It's what they love so much, California, because the wines are going to taste pretty much the same every single year because the season and the weather is very stable and very easy to reproduce. And it's like that. And some varietals are more suitable for that. So by routine, by rules, by climate and the soil component, Cabernet Sauvignon, it's a very tricky varietal for us here. Even if we have the ripeness sometimes, we can have 12-13% of alcohol, but we have this kind of East Coast to North signature of Ontario. We have the acidity. We have this fresh acid level in the grapes. And it's not always the best on a Cabernet Sauvignon.
Yeah.
Just for the big aging of, if you keep that in 20 or 30 years in your cellar, just to have a crazy bottle, perhaps you're going to reduce the acidity. It's not the easiest, it's not the most natural, and it's not, perhaps not the smartest varietal to plant. But at the same time, we have to reposition the viticulture in Ontario. 30, 40, 50 years ago, it was just the beginning. And the first guy who planted the vineyard wanted to experiment everything. And of course, if you put on top some kind of sales guys who wanted to put some vines in the ground here, just coming and just doing. Just the big success was California. So why not to try to reproduce California?
Even though it doesn't work.
I'm still a bit reluctant because just again, for 1 or 2 years, when we're going to have some beautiful, nice Cabernet Sauvignon, we have some issues with the ripeness, with the cold of the winter, the survival of the vines. We have some issues with how soft we can have the wine after because of the acid, because of the tannins. You know, unripe tannins on Cabernet, good luck.
Yeah,
if you are born with that, you can say you like it. It's not the most exciting part of the Cabernet Sauvignon.
No. And I got to tell you, if I see an Ontario wine and it's 100% Cabernet Sauvignon, I don't trust it. Like, I go in wary, like it's a horror movie. No, I don't trust you. You're going to kill me. So I agree. And you're right. There are some years I've tried a couple 100% cab that I enjoyed, but it's a low success rate. But another quote, I think also from 2010, you were not convinced about Pinot Noir working here in Niagara. And I'm curious, and the quote was, "I'm not convinced, decrying the vast majority of local Pinots that JP had tasted." I'm trying to remember where I found this article. That was a decade ago. I'm curious where you stand now on Niagara Pinot Noir.
Well, you know, it's my relationship with Pinot Noir, it's kind of a love-hate relation because, of course, I'm from Burgundy. So, of course, you have lots of Pinot Noir. But being from Burgundy, I'm more a Chardonnay winemaker. Chablis being 100% Chardonnay, yeah. I'm a Chardonnay winemaker. And I'm pretty much more a Pinot Noir drinker. So that means just when I arrived in 2000 in Ontario, and when I discovered the Pinot Noir, and when I discovered the big excitement of everybody about the Pinot Noir, I was just, okay, so sorry, but just it's not there. The vineyards, the weather, the feeling, and perhaps even the knowledge just of the people, of the growers, of the winemakers, the knowledge of the customers. Everybody is dreaming about Pinot Noir, but after just what is a big Pinot Noir? Just are we talking about Burgundy? Are we talking about some different region, different worlds, different countries, different continents? It's very tricky. It's a very finicky varietal. It's right that I was not satisfied. And I think, not only I think, but I know I also said in the first years in 2000 that I'm never going to make Pinot Noir. Mm-hmm. And guess what? I've changed.
What changed? What happened?
You know, just in fact, in 2009, and it was not the best vintage, but it was a very cold vintage. But it was a very long Indian summer. In fact, it was a cold summer. We have no sun. We have no heat. We have nothing up to the end of August. It was very late peak, and I managed to discover that some Pinot Noir vineyards were not picked from some of my growers were just growing Pinot Noir for someone else. And at this time, just basically, I was visiting the vineyard. I was still touring the vineyard for some other varietal. And I just realized that this vineyard of Pinot Noir was not picked. And I went to see the grower and I said, the winery doesn't want to go because it's not ready, and and after being not ready and just the rot came on it, the botrytis, I'm just coming from the vineyard. I said, yes, you have some rot, you have lots of rot, but what's left over is just incredible. And it was 2009, yeah. And basically I decided to pick and to make my first Pinot Noir, and I picked the Pinot Noir in the 4th of November.
Yeah.
Whoa. So, the reaction, whoa.
Well, that's late.
Very, very unusual.
Yeah.
And very, very special. Lots of sorting to do in the vineyards. And basically, I think I dropped 2/3 of the crop in the field. And after I've done an extra sorting in the sorting table at the winery, and I managed to ferment and to do the first Pinot Noir. And in fact, it was, 14.2. 14.4% of alcohol natural because of a little bit of the botrytis and everything. And I've kept some in tank. I put some in barrels. I put some in old barrels, and I've done my first. And I knew all the people, the media, even my colleagues, they were waiting for me to say, okay, Jean-Pierre, you put so much on this varietal. You were always so critic of the Pinot Noir that we are waiting for you. I know they are all waiting for me with the rifle, waiting to shoot me on the butt.
Yeah.
And just to say, okay, what have you done? And you know, guess what? After the aging, after the bottling, when we started to taste that officially on the market with the colleagues and the media and things like that, just wow, you know, just this is a great exercise. But and okay, that means just you don't have always the truth. You have to react with what you have. It's why just basically when I say react with the climate, the condition, and I have I'm very stubborn. I'm very bad. I don't listen to everybody. Or basically, yes, I'm listening to everybody, but I'm turning that and making my own little way. And I'm still growing. When I say there is lots of common sense on the wine growing or on the wine making, you know, just basically, it seems to be natural to do some things. It seems not to be natural to do some other things. And sometimes you don't have to reinvent the story. You know, you don't have to. And I don't consider myself as a Pinot Noir winemaker, but I have done that in my own way, just following my own feelings, respecting the grapes, being very, very cautious of what to do, where to go. And basically, I'm just always the first one to say, I want to showcase the grapes. I want to showcase the soil. I want to respect the vineyard. If I prefer this vineyard compared to this other vineyard, if I prefer this soil compared to this other soil, it's just because there is something on the back. So I'm very low intervention. I can be a very big lazy guy.
Yeah.
If I don't have to work, I'm not working. If I don't want to do it twice. So basically, taking the right decision and making the job at the right moment, doing it at the right way. So just basically, it's based on the understanding of your grapes. Basically, understanding of your soil, what you have to do, and what seems to be so obvious. You know, when you have this kind of grapes, don't try to make a very opposite, total different wine.
Yeah.
You know, your grapes, when you taste the grapes, when you taste the juice, your grapes are going to tell you, okay, this is the way I am. And basically, you're going to feel that this is the way it's going to go. If you want to transform, if you want to put a big hand on your grapes, you're going to have something totally fake, totally make up. And I think you're not going to have the best result. I'm just basically winemaker, top winemaker, just with big score, big. Even on my past life in Burgundy and saying that. Doesn't mean anything. Just you have to understand what you have in front of you, what kind of grapes you have, and you have to understand what you can do with it. So basically, you have to stick on the original potential, just to try to put it in light. You don't want to transform everything. You know, you don't have to follow the recipe. You don't have to say, okay, I'm going to do that. No, I'm going to do what the grapes is able to do for me.
So that's the end of part one of the interview with Jean-Pierre Collat from 13th Street Winery. The second part starts with me actually offering to pour more of the sparkling just because I wanted to drink more of it. He said no, but you'll be able to check out the second part of my interview with JP Collat. That podcast should be up just around the same time. Again, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.